Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. What do New York City's Delmonico's restaurant, New Orleans Antoine's, the Mandarin in San Francisco, and the chain of Howard Johnson's that once spanned the American landscape all have in common? According to Yale professor Paul Friedman, they're all part of an elite group that he's identified as the 10 restaurants that changed America. We'll sit down with Paul to hear more about his research on that topic. Then, we have a visit with Delmonico's chef, Billy Oliva, and learn how he is constantly adapting the restaurant's age-old classics to accommodate the tastes of today. Finally, Rick Blunt, fifth-generation Antoine's family member, gives us a personal tour of the New Orleans landmark. We're traveling back in time while keeping one foot securely in the 21st century on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Paul Friedman. I'm the author of a book called 10 Restaurants That Changed America.
As a young graduate student at UC Berkeley, Paul Friedman's thesis focused on medieval history. This led him to study the culinary tastes of medieval people and to author a book on that subject. Mr. Friedman's latest book, 10 Restaurants That Changed America, focuses on more current American culinary history and restaurants that were crucial to forging that history. Paul, welcome to Louisiana Eats, and such an honor to have you here in the studio with us.
Well, it's an honor and a pleasure for me to be here.
I am so curious about so many things that have to do with this book, and I understand that in order to write the book, you literally poured through hundreds of thousands of restaurants over two centuries. What's your criteria?
My criteria is really influence, restaurants that were influential, not necessarily restaurants that were wonderful or whose food conforms to our current standards of what we admire.
So walk us through the 10 and why they were selected for this honor.
Well, chronologically, the first is Delmonico's. And this is Delmonico's in New York, and it was established in about 1830. It's really the first restaurant in the United States, by restaurant meaning a place that gives you a choice of what to order from a menu, a choice of who you want to eat with. It also dominated fine dining and the image of fine dining throughout the 19th century. The second is Antoine's in New Orleans, chosen as a representative of the most vibrant and long-lasting regional cuisine of the United States, and also one of the oldest restaurants in the United States.
Second oldest,
exactly.
Continuously operating.
And the oldest continuously operated by the same family. So then Schraft's, which was a chain of restaurants in the Northeast that really got going around 1900, and it is a pioneer of middle-class dining, so not elegant like Antoine's and Delmonico's, but not just a kind of hash house or luncheonette. The other reason it's important is that it was among the first restaurants to appeal to women, not just by atmosphere, but by the kind of food that women were thought to like. Light food, but also fancy desserts, ice cream in particular.
So if you were to dine at Schraft's, what might a typical meal there be like?
Well, I can tell you based on my grandmother, who loved Schraft's. My grandmother would have had cottage cheese and fruit or chicken salad or club sandwich, something pretty light, and then follow it up with a banana split or a sundae.
Well, that's what it was designed for.
So my next restaurant is Howard Johnson's. Howard Johnson's is the pioneer in the fast food industry because it invents franchising, and it also is the first restaurant as a chain to establish itself on the road and to appeal to the traveler in families.
On the road around the corner, here's the place to go. The orange roof of Howard Johnson's. Join the folks who know.
So it was the first kind of family-friendly restaurant, and it was the largest restaurant chain in the U.S. In the 1960s, it served more meals than any other institution except for the U.S. Army.
How many Howard Johnson's were there in its heyday?
About 1,000, coast to coast.
1,000?
Yes, and there's only one left. It's in Lake George, New York. It survives as the last of the franchisees. So Howard Johnson had franchises and it had restaurants owned by the company. When the company was broken up and sold, the franchisees were orphaned and they folded slowly and gradually as they either turned into some other restaurant or just closed, retired, couldn't make any money. So this is the last one.
Who was Howard Johnson?
He's like a number of founders of companies, a fanatic, a workaholic, very innovative, always tinkering with the look of the place, the marketing, the advertising, the architecture, the image. So he's really one of these founding geniuses of American business, the Henry Ford of the restaurant world. So my next pair of restaurants are what used to be called ethnic restaurants, a Chinese restaurant called the Mandarin in San Francisco. And the justification for that is you can't write about American restaurants without including Chinese restaurants. There are 40,000 of them today, more than McDonald's, KFC, and Burger King's combined. And then Mama Leone's, an Italian restaurant in New York, now closed. Mama Leone's was both a bohemian little kind of Chianti bottle with a candle in it place when it was founded in 1906, well into the 1920s, and then it became the largest restaurant in the United States in terms of size. It could serve easily 3,000, 3,500 people a night.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, it was huge. And it had huge quantities of food. That was its signature. And a kind of stereotypical Italian joyous atmosphere. All the ladies were assured that the desserts had no calories. The waiters were flirtatious. The atmosphere was sort of operatic or artificially operatic, but it was an extremely successful restaurant and represented what people thought Italian food was for decades.
And who was Mama Leone?
Louisa Leone was the wife of a wine importer in New York, and she was a very good cook and cooked for friends, and Enrico Caruso was among the people who not so much convinced her to open a restaurant, because she was all for it, but convinced her husband in 1906 that this was a good idea, and they turned their front room of their brownstone or townhouse or glorified tenement building in the midtown neighborhood of the Metropolitan Opera, which was on 39th Street, into a restaurant, and it was tremendously successful. She was always very good at quantities. Her husband had the habit of inviting dozens of people to dinner without giving her much more than 2 hours warning. And she never complained about this. Not only knew how to do it, but considered that the normal way of doing business.
Tell me about the Mandarin in San Francisco. You know, San Francisco's got Chinatown. I guess Chinatown was pretty much always there. The Mandarin came along in 1961, so this wasn't revolutionary new Chinese food.
Well, it was a little bit on the revolutionary side because it served northern Chinese food and not Cantonese. It was high-end and not inexpensive. It was the first place that I ever had things like pot stickers, hot and sour soup, Peking duck, these northern specialties that now have become so standard. It was unusual in that it was the creation of a woman in what was a man's business, a woman who was not from southern China, was not Cantonese, and it wasn't in Chinatown. It first was on Polk Street, in, west of Chinatown in San Francisco, and then it moved to Ghirardelli Square, one of the first historical restorations of an old candy factory, and very beautiful and very high-end, and it had prestigious customers or famous customers like John Lennon ate there regularly. The Jefferson Airplane, a famous rock group of the 60s, ate there. Its proprietor, its founder, Cecilia Chang, is perhaps the most striking, unusual, and entertaining person I've met in doing this research. She's now 97, very much active in the restaurant world, very much someone who seems to dine out all the time, can easily drink me under the table, has had a fascinating life and created the Mandarin almost really by accident in 1961. She was investing in what she thought was someone else's business, and the other people pulled out of it, leaving her holding a $10,000 debt. And so she figured she'd better try to open the restaurant herself. She was not an expert cook. She had grown up in a very wealthy family with two chefs and wasn't allowed in the kitchen because it wasn't appropriate for a woman of her class to learn such things. So she, too, is a genius, different kind of genius from Howard Deering Johnson, and one who is still influential in the American food scene and a legend.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Paul Friedman about the 10 restaurants that changed America. Stay tuned. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup and the Toasted Muffalata, lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. And now, our conversation with Paul Friedman, author of The 10 Restaurants That Changed America, continues.
Sylvia's in New York, founded in 1962, a very prosperous restaurant to this day, represents Southern food, the migration of Southern food to the North with the great migration of African Americans beginning around the First World War, and the different ways in which Southern food, soul food, what's sometimes called country cooking or down-home cooking, the interaction of these concepts.
Who were the people who owned Sylvia's?
They're a family from South Carolina. Sylvia Woods herself, her grandfather had been lynched, essentially, for a murder he didn't commit. Her grandmother didn't know how to read or write. They owned a farm. Her memories of Hemingway, South Carolina, are of a kind of idyllic life, despite this harsh treatment and subordination. There was a restaurant in Hemingway, but black people weren't allowed in it. So she had basically almost never been in a restaurant when she opened Sylvia's. She worked for a man who owned a luncheonette, and he sold it to her, and that's what became Sylvia's in 1962.
Sylvia's opened. Was it segregated?
No, but Harlem had been the nightclub district of New York, particularly during Prohibition and a little bit in the 1930s. In 1962, it was still a neighborhood that had whites and blacks dining and to some extent going to entertainments together. But beginning in the mid-60s, it was segregated more by whites who were both afraid of what they regarded as a dangerous part of town and who tended to marginalize that part of town. African Americans themselves traveled all over New York to go to school, to have jobs. So it was really more a question of white people in New York perceiving the neighborhood as really having no attractions. When politicians would campaign at Sylvia's, white politicians like Ed Koch, the mayor for many years, thought it was actually the only restaurant in Harlem. When it was reviewed by Gail Green in New York Magazine in the 1970s, she said in retrospect her editor was doubtful about her going there because it would encourage readers to do something dangerous, namely go to Harlem, presumably white readers, naturally. And that really astounds me. It's as if you were encouraging people to drive 100 miles an hour or do something reckless. And, you know, would they get into trouble if suddenly people following Gail Green's review showed up in Harlem and got into trouble somehow? And she herself was amazed at the welcome she received, the fact that there was really, although the only problem she really had was getting a taxi to take her up to Harlem. In those days, taxi drivers flat out refused to. So it's really a demonstration of something that is a persistent aspect of segregation in the North, where it wasn't legislated, but it was, as in many respects, it remains a fact of life.
And they're still open today.
They're prospering today. They're doing very well, yeah. And they have very good food. They're right next to Red Rooster, the Marcus Samuelson restaurant, which has a more kind of perhaps hip take on African-American food, and the two restaurants seem to reinforce each other rather than competing.
Is their menu still the same?
They've taken some things off from their old menu. So some things that giblets, chicken gizzards. So there are more chicken and ribs and vegetables, collard greens, that kind of thing.
So for our next two restaurants, I suppose it would be wise to talk about Le Pavillon and the Four Seasons sort of in the same vein.
Definitely, because Le Pavillon, which opened in 1941 and closed in the mid-1970s, was the epitome of high-end French dining, which dominated American food at the high end until the 1970s and 80s. Le Pavillon was the creation of Henri Soulet. It was called Pavillon because it began as the restaurant at the French Pavilion of the World's Fair of 1939-40. And the Nazi invasion of France, the Blitzkrieg that destroyed the French government in the spring of 1940, stranded these restaurant workers, and Henri Soulet rallied them and created a restaurant in Manhattan that from the start, even in that inauspicious year 1941, was the place to dine, the place not only to be seen, but that everybody agreed had the best food. But best food at that time meant French food. Four Seasons, founded in 1959, was as elegant as Le Pavillon, although not in a kind of French Belle Époque manner, but in a magnificent modernist Bauhaus idiom. And it was deliberately not French. So that was the first high-end not French restaurant. It's hard to say exactly what it was. It certainly pioneered seasonality in certain respects as we know it. They had greens that they gathered, that they foraged. They had mushrooms. They had an herb garden. At the same time, they defined seasonal not as local. So if truffles were in season in France, they imported truffles. They had a lot of imported items, salmon from Norway, for example, Dover sole, always a signature item. So they weren't exactly in anticipation of what we now know as local and seasonal. They weren't even exactly American, but they were the first restaurant really to emphasize something that was not French at the high end.
Yet not American at the Four Seasons in many ways. From there, you go to the last one on your list, and I don't think you get any more American in a new American way than Chez Panisse.
That's right. Chez Panisse, on the other hand, as its name tells you, began as a French restaurant. So that in 1971, when it was founded, Four Seasons would seem to be much more innovative than Chez Panisse. Chez Panisse began with Alice Waters' dream of recreating a rural French auberge that served just a few dishes. But her governing concept of quality of the basic ingredients as opposed to exoticness of the basic ingredients, her focus on local and on seasonal, and some influences such as particular chefs, the influence of Provence and Italy, steered her towards a kind of cuisine that, for want of a better term, could be called New American. I know that she herself has told me she doesn't like the term California cuisine. Mm-hmm. So it is a rediscovery of something that Americans, we haven't really liked or thought about that much. We've tended to like variety or new things or imported stuff, and not focused on how good is this peach, how good is this tomato, how interesting is this cheese. It's more how far away did this come from, or how many varieties of yogurt can I get, even though they're all made in a factory. The fact that this has changed is due to Chez Panisse, and I would say of all the restaurants in my list of 10, this is the one that people in the food writing and food industry world always accept without question. Nobody has said, oh, what's Chez Panisse doing in there?
Well, if you could dine anywhere in history today, where would you choose to dine? What is sort of your great holy grail of restaurants after having done all this research?
Well, I think I'd try Delmonico's in the 19th century. So it'd be some 19th century restaurant, because what I'd like to have would be that terrapin. I'd like to have wild canvasback ducks with celery sauce, which is the other great specialty of the 19th century.
Well, I am so glad that I had this incredible opportunity to sit down and talk with you about your amazing new book. It's really a book that whether you're a chef or an eater, you'll want to devour from cover to cover. So thank you for making this time for us, Paul.
Well, thank you, Poppy. It's been an adventure for me and always a pleasure to be in New Orleans.
Paul Friedman, author of 10 Restaurants That Changed America. Established in 1840, Antoine's Restaurant is the oldest continuously operating family-run restaurant in America. Through war, epidemics, and natural disasters, founder Antoine Alciatoire and his descendants have maintained their elegant dining tradition. Today's CEO, Rick Blunt, is working hard to ensure Antoine's relevance in the 21st century restaurant scene.
Everybody asks me that all the time. They say, Rick, is Antoine's a, is this a tourist restaurant? Do people from out of town dine here? Or is this a local restaurant? And I can't figure out a meaningful statistic that makes any sense at all. Again, one of those roles that Antoine's plays in the dynamic of New Orleans is that we're this sort of quintessential New Orleans experience. And so when you're entertaining your out-of-town guests, is this a local dinner or is this an out-of-town dinner? Half the people at the table are local, the other half the people are out of town. So it's very difficult for me to come up with any sort of an idea of who we serve more of. I honestly don't think we serve more of one group or the other. It's just what we do.
Standing in the middle of the Rex Room as lunch is being cleared, Rick Blunt brings up an interesting point about Antoine's restaurant. As guests leave, Rick shakes their hands and knows them all on a first-name basis. Perhaps that's because the French Quarter restaurant has been in his family for five generations.
The family name is Alciator. So my mom was an Alciator. But being a woman, you get married and kids end up with their dad's name. So I'm an Alciator by blood, but a Blunt by name.
That's wonderful. Rick, it's quite a trick, though. The restaurant business is tricky, goodness knows. But to hang on to a business through succession, through death, through war, how have you all managed to do this?
Well, I don't know that there was ever a plan. I guess probably the best history is one that wasn't written in advance. But the single biggest reason that the family was able to make it this far is that there was a giant consolidation in the second generation. Antoine started the restaurant. He and his wife operated the little pension and the restaurant downstairs. And his son, Jules, a middle son, purchased the business and the real estate from mom after dad died. So when Antoine died, Jules bought the business. That consolidated the trunk. That gave us a second generation that could be manageably passed to the third generation.
Rick gave us a personal tour of all the Mardi Gras crew rooms at Antoine's. Of course, we began in the room dedicated to the king of carnival himself, Rex.
Rex is the original history. And I love the traditions of Rex. Rex themselves do several parties here. They do their king's party here. They do a queen's party here. They do multiple other events during the year here. But it's also a room that's available to Antoine's. It's available to anyone. Like all of the other dining rooms at Antoine's, there's no rhyme or reason why you would have one or the other. It's your preference as a diner. Uh-huh. So anyone can reserve any room. There's no charge. There's no preference. If it's available, I've served many couples for their anniversary, just a party of two in the Rex Room, because that's what they wanted to do. So all of these rooms are available to everyone.
How far back does the association go between Rex and Antoine's?
Back to 1942 was when the room was built. My grandfather, Roy Alciator, agreed to the formation of a Rex Room and to begin the pieces of it. And of course, it's evolved and grown and so on in scope of how it's worked out. But our association, I think, goes back a lot further than that. I would really say, or I have said, and I think it only makes good sense. One of the roles that Antoine's plays in the community of New Orleans is that it's kind of a place where things happen. It wouldn't surprise me at all that the gentleman who formed Rex dined here. People ask me that. Well, when did Rex anoint Antoine's? I would be willing to bet that it happened in the opposite way. I would be willing to bet that the gentlemen that formed Rex were already customers here, and they were already dining here, and they were discussing this grand idea of a Mardi Gras in New Orleans, probably here. And so why did they stay here? Well, it was just natural, because it's where they were anyway.
So where do we go next?
Let's go to Proteus.
Okay. In the Proteus room, Rick explained that he's challenged the old line crew to bring out their playful spirit while maintaining their focus on history. The Proteus Room is a bit more staid and formal than some of the others, befitting Mardi Gras' second oldest parade and crew. Its most imposing feature is a giant Proteus crest, worthy of the god of the seas.
Proteus does do a lot of functions here, not necessarily in their Royal Room, because they certainly couldn't fit the organization in this room. On Lundi Gras, on Proteus Monday, we host a party for the members of Proteus, and it's about 200 guests. Now, that's not their total membership. That's just the gentlemen that show up for the one party. So 200 people are not going to fit in the Proteus room, no matter what you do. If you stood them on top of each other, they wouldn't fit. But we can fit them in the large annex. And so we do a beautiful sit-down dinner, which is really a fun, you know, a fun day. Proteus Monday is one of the really, really, truly fun days at Antoine's.
Okay, where are we going next?
Well, since we're downstairs, we ought to go to Hermes.
The Hermes room was the last crew room added to Antoine's. And in 2009, it was repurposed as the restaurant's first patron bar. The crew of Hermes loved it. But Rick saw the bar as a chance for Antoine's to evolve.
Because it's so funny, you know, for years people would walk up to it and they'd bump into the trademark and they'd say, wow, we bumped into Antoine's. And then they would ask one of my waiters to take their picture.
Oh.
And then they would move on. Oh. Because there was no way to interact with the business. There was no way to have a memory. There was no way to meet anyone. There was no way to do anything at Antoine's without the bar. And without the Hermes bar, I had no slush fund. I had no way to ask a customer to pardon me for a few minutes or anything else. So it was important to me to do that. And then secondly, it was important for me to sort of stodgy down the image of Antoine's. Once inside Antoine's, I think people let their hair down, but not on their way in. I think the tradition of being very, very formal had run too much of its course. And we were seen as being too fancy for our own good.
Or perhaps Grandma and Grandpa's restaurant, not some place that the 20 or 30-somethings would necessarily be willing to go.
Exactly. Very, very much to the point. My daughter at a very young age, maybe 15 years old, had really candid discussions with me and said, you know, Dad, you know, my friends would never go to Antoine's, you know, on their own nickel because, you know, who wants to be boring? You know, who wants to be formal? And so it was like, wow, what a bad perception. And truly a wrong perception. Because if anything, Antoine's is this celebratory place that's always been incredibly fun. You know, it was never the formal of a joint. It was even throughout its entire history, it's been this sort of a European-French bistro environment, not this formal environment. But I don't know that I could have convinced
my daughter
and her friends of that, because what they saw was this formality that got in the way with having fun.
Okay, where do you want us to go now?
You want to go 12th Night?
Sure.
Are you
absolutely
on?
12th Night.
Come on, we'll go up the back stairs.
As we made our way upstairs to the 12th Night Revelers Room, it struck me that Rick's constantly juggling innovation and tradition. Antoine's is so many things to so many different people, and all of them have their own expectations that go with it. Not only is Rick expected to uphold those traditions, but he's also tasked with making the restaurant accessible for younger generations of patrons. It can be a challenge, especially when he goes over the annual Mardi Gras menus with the crews.
I don't think the Mardi Gras crews in general go out on a limb very far. You know, they're members are expecting this sort of classic Antoine's meal. And although every year we have many meetings about the menu and how we're going to serve it and all that stuff, at least up until now, we haven't gone that far out on a limb for that. So,
well, honestly, I think that people come to Antoine's and expect to have their favorite Antoine's meal.
Yeah. Sometimes I worry about them, though, a little bit, because many, many times I'll see the same group of gentlemen five, six, seven times in a 3-week period. I don't know. I love a filet with Marchand de Vin sauce. You know, I mean, I think that is a classic, classic dish. It's wonderful. But after seven of them, I might be looking to order something different. You know what I mean? So every year I do talk to the crews and ask them to think about varying up our menus just a little bit so that it stays exciting and fun and interesting to their guests, because we want that to be an exciting experience and a fun, you know, way to do dinner.
Rick Blunt, fifth generation proprietor at Antoine's Restaurant. How was that magic dish, palm souffle, invented? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How was that magic dish, palm souffle, invented? Antoine's Restaurant founder, Antoine Alciatoire, was just 14 years old and apprenticed to the great French chef Colinet when a great banquet was planned for Louis-Philippe, the King of France. His Majesty, Louis-Philippe, preferred his pommes frites, that's French fries, very crispy. So the chef instructed young Antoine to cut the potatoes in a certain way. He followed the chef's instructions, and when told that the king's arrival was imminent, he plunged them into the hot lard for cooking. As they began to turn golden brown, a runner appeared with the news that the king was not on the train as expected. Antoine pulled all the potatoes out of the boiling oil and set them aside on trays. Worried that this very important dish would be ruined, he instructed his helpers to stoke the fires to ensure the oil would be smoking hot. When the time came, and the potatoes were placed back into the now hotter oil, they miraculously puffed up like little balloons. Everyone, from his mentor Colinet to the king himself, applauded Antoine's invention. And today, pommes soufflées remain a great specialty at the restaurant, which still bears his name. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Antoine's pommes soufflées are real Louisiana Eats. Established in 1837, Delmonico's Restaurant in New York City is the nation's oldest continuously operating restaurant. A myriad of American standards like Lobster Newberg, Chicken a la King, and Baked Alaska were all created at Delmonico's. I had the honor of speaking with sales and marketing director Karen Serafin and executive chef Billy Oliva to get the scoop on the restaurant's remarkable history.
The Delmonico's brothers came here from Switzerland, and originally their plan was just to have a little pastry shop. When they came to the United States from Switzerland, they were astounded to find out how barbaric the Americans really were, because there was no such thing as a restaurant. The only place that you could have a meal was either at an inn or a tavern, and you had to have whatever the innkeeper was preparing that day. They said to themselves, you know what, let's gather our money. They had $20,000, which was quite a bit of money back then. And they decided to actually open up the first restaurant.
So Karen, how did the dishes get their names? I mean, Newburgh, A La King, Alaska, like what's all that about?
The Delmonico brothers were very fond of naming their dishes after customers. I think the most fascinating one is the one that involves lobster Newburgh. There was a sea captain, Captain Wenberg, who used to be a frequent customer of Delmonico's, and he used to come to the restaurant, and every time he came, he would always bring a lobster with him after his fishing expedition, and he would ask the chef to create a special dish. And the chef would create this amazing dish, and they finally ended up putting it on the menu because it was so popular, and they named it Lobster Wenberg. And it was a very, very popular dish. But unfortunately, one day, the captain, sea captain, and the chef had a falling out, and they had a very big argument. And the chef was so angry with him that he said, "We're taking the lobster off the menu." And the guests were up in arms because it was a very, very popular item. And they kept asking him, "Please put it back, please put it back." So they did put it back. However, they changed it from Wenberg to Newburgh so that it wasn't recognizable and he wasn't given credit. And that's how that dish got named.
I would love it if you would actually take us through the front of the house experience at Delmonico's.
Well, when you walk down the street and you first see the facade of Delmonico's, it's a very impressive image because, first of all, you see these wonderful grand pillars, and they're from the ruins of Pompeii. And they're said to be good luck if you rub them. So sometimes you see people walking in and out of the restaurant rubbing the pillars. And then you open the front door, and you're greeted with this, you know, very expansive beautiful dining room that has a very classic, elegant feel, but at the same time doesn't feel old. It feels very welcoming, and you feel like you're sort of in this very magical space. We have restored it and renovated and redesigned while still keeping the, you know, classic elements of it, but also staying contemporary. And then on our lower level, we have incredible private dining rooms.
Now that we know what Delmonico's looks like, what about the food? Here's executive chef Billy Oliva to discuss Delmonico's food then and now. I read your bio, and it fascinates me that you knew you wanted to work in restaurants and be involved with food when you were just 12 years old, and how providential that it was even so close by to where you are today.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I kind of went full circle. 12 years old. My brother was the general manager at Francis Tavern. My dad passed away real early. So it all kind of happened pretty quick. I was off school for the summer. My brother brought me to work and says, "You're going to work in the restaurant. You're going to wash dishes. You're going to peel potatoes." And I think I was there for about a day, and I saw a guy flambe a dish. And I said, "That's what I want to do."
So you are a Culinary Institute graduate, though. You went to the Culinary Institute of America at Hyde Park. What happens next in your career?
Well, right out of college, I went to work for the Lovanos family. They have Oceana in Midtown Manhattan, and it was Rick Moonen, who I spent about a year with working in the different Lovano family restaurants. From there, I left there and went into the city and hooked up back with my brother at a restaurant that was called Harbor Lights, and that was right across the river from the River Cafe. And matter of fact, there I worked with John Loughran, who at one point was the executive chef at the River Cafe. He worked under David Burke.
This, to me, is the thing I'm the most curious about, because the Delmonico's menu, just like the menu at any of New Orleans' classic restaurants, especially Antoine's, there are the absolute, just benchmark dishes that you can't mess with.
The classic dishes are the hardest dishes to work with for a few reasons. One, I get bored really quick. Two, New York is so fast-paced. You know, you blink your eye and there's a new food trend out. You know, whether it's black garlic, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, there's always something new. So to be current and to be in the whole mix, you need to have a portion of the new as well. So, you know, those dishes were, a lot of those dishes were invented by Charles Ranhofer, who they say was maybe the first celebrity chef. And, you know, you can't change those, but you can try and make them better. And, you know, maybe little different cooking techniques that we have available to us today that weren't available back then. You know, a dish like chicken a la quine, I always try what I try and do in any of the restaurants. I don't want you to be able to duplicate anything that we do in your house. You know, I want you to come there and say, wow, this is unbelievable. So like for that dish, we've changed it up. We use, we make a farro pasta. We kind of eliminated the noodles and we went to farro, a little bit healthier farro pasta. Now we have all kinds of great seasonal mushrooms available to us. I think right now is lobster mushrooms. Burgundy truffles are around as well now. So we always try and change it up that way. The chicken at the moment we're cooking, and I think this one is going to stay for a while because it's really working well. So we're doing a version when we cook the chicken, we cook it like a brick chicken, only we're using a Himalayan salt brick. Yeah. So the flavor that comes through with the salt brick and the crispiness of the skin, and also it helps us with speed. So that's kind of what we do with those classical dishes. The only one we don't mess around with too much, because it's kind of hard to, is Eggs Benedict. The only thing we've changed were Canadian bacon, Black Forest ham, and I think we found that a prosciutto cotto works really well with the rosemary and the hollandaise and caviar and the truffle.
Do you think that there's anything that you have created that might have the stick-to-itiveness of some of the Delmonico's originals?
My one boss is very, would love us to be like a classic steakhouse restaurant. And we are heavy red meat, but we are anything but a, you know, to me, we're not a classic steakhouse because we do so much more. But he wanted some bacon because it's a big thing in New York, bacon, just grilled, seared bacon as a side dish, as an appetizer. So I says, okay, we're gonna play around with some bacon. So we got in some pork belly and we cured it, we smoked it, and it took us about 6 weeks to get it where we wanted to get it. And that has kind of taken off in Delmonico's. We do about 20 pork bellies a week that we start to cure to keep them going. It cures for about 7 to 10 days. We smoke it for about 12 hours. Then it's packaged up and sous vide for 2 days at about 140 degrees. So it's like butter when you eat it. It's, and we finish it with an aged maple that's aged in bourbon barrels for about 2 years. So really good. So maybe that is one of the dishes that seems to be taken off and might stick around for a while.
I will say, I think that dish has legs because I'm just going to, in the future, refer to that as Billy's Bacon. So
that's it. That's kind of what it is on the menu now. And it was one of the owners who said, you have to say Billy's Bacon. I wanted to say Billy's Bacon.
So I just want to say thank you so much for making time during your visit.
Believe me, I'm going to be coming back a lot more.
That was executive chef Billy Oliva and sales and marketing director Karen Serafin of Delmonico's Restaurant in New York. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we celebrate Halloween with a hauntingly good show.
Takes a picture, and he's looking at the picture. There's a face of someone looking in the pane from the outside, looking in towards us.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets.
Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and with support from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.